It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here from the BEA Beautiful Studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com here in Phoenix, Arizona. And we have on the line Gareth Porter. Now, Gareth is an investigative journalist and historian that specializes in U.S. national security policy, and he has a recent article about the Iranian scientist that the CIA had. And they're going to milk him for whatever they could, whether he told them whatever they said he told them or not. You know, the administration, somebody's going to, you know, do whatever they want with it. But we have, you know, information from people in the know that says what? That even the CIA knows, you know, they're kind of fudging the truth on the lamestream media, the media that's so last century. But here on Declare Your Independence on Freedom's Phoenix, we get to the source here. Gareth, I got you there.
Yes, I'm right here.
You know, we just had, yesterday we didn't finish up, a good friend of mine, and we brought him back today, a good friend of yours, Mr. Scott Horton. And man, did he have all kinds of good things to say about y'all.
So, yes, Scott is a good friend.
So he's like, man, oh, you got Gareth Porter on, you're going to get what fur? So tell us every little old thing, this entire, let me think what's coming to mind. It's coming to mind, it's on the tip of my tongue, it's curveball, okay?
Curveball, indeed.
You know, I can see this whole thing, same deal, amping up. It's like a template. It's like it's a plan that they pull off the shelf. They don't even have to blow the dust off of it. They're using it all the time. You know, it's Iraq with curveball. It's Iran with, you know, Amiri. So tell me this whole story. Give me a quickie 5-minute deal and get us up to speed.
Well, let's begin with curveball because it is a very useful starting point to talk about this Iranian scientist, Shahram Amiri. And the relationship, of course, is that the CIA fell hook, line, and sinker for this Iraqi so-called defector who told them about these mobile biological weapons labs in Saddam's Iraq, which we now know, of course, didn't exist. But they fell for it hook, line, and sinker. He turned out to be a liar, and the CIA later on caught on to his act, but it was too late by then. Now, the relationship here is that it's very clear the CIA badly wanted to have their curveball before, of course, he turned out to be a liar on the Iranian nuclear program. They were trying every way they could to penetrate the Iranian nuclear program. So this is happening in 2005, 2006, 2007. And who walks into a U.S. consulate in Turkey but Shahram Amiri, a scientist who is, he's very honest. He's peripheral to the nuclear program of Iran. He's not really a player. He's not really a nuclear scientist. He's a radiologist. He's somebody who studies radiation safety. But he knows some of the scientists who are in the program, and he's heard stuff. He always heard scuttlebutt. And so, you know, he says, I'm interested in helping the United States know more about what's going on in Iran. He offers to be an intelligence asset for the United States. And I'm told that the CIA then, you know, has an agent handler who is in relationship with him, and the guy begins to send reports through a satellite-based mechanism. Now, exactly when this starts, it's not clear. But in any case, 2007 comes, and somehow or other, the United States gets the idea that he's in danger of being found out, that the Iranian intelligence agency is in danger of finding out that he's sending them reports. And so they suggest to him that it's time to get out of Iran and relocate him to the United States. Now, normally, under these circumstances, the entire family would be moved for obvious reasons. This is a guy who has a young 9-year-old son, as I recall, and a wife, of course. And instead, what happens is that he requests that the family not be moved to the United States, to relocate to the United States with him. Now, all of this adds up to a very, very strong suspicion on the part of a lot of people now looking back within the CIA that he was a double agent, or as is often called in the world of intelligence, a dangle, somebody who offers to work for a foreign intelligence agency, but is in fact working for his own country's intelligence agency all along.
Okay, now before we go further, I want to ask, what was his motivation, or at least stated motivation, for him going to the U.S. to do this to begin with? I mean, he needed, transplants or something? I mean, he wanted money?
The motivation that I presume he told the U.S. About to begin with to establish a relationship was that he was out of sympathy with the Iranian government. You know, he felt that they were oppressive and so on and so forth, and so he was willing to help to try to learn more about the nuclear program. But the move to the United States, as I understand it, and as has been published actually in various accounts, is that he was being told that he was in danger by U.S. intelligence, or he told the U.S. intelligence that he was in danger. We're not sure exactly what happened. So it was to escape being detected or being caught that he was relocated to the United States.
Did he give a reason why he didn't want his wife and child to come with him?
As far as I know, he did not. That is an ambiguity that I'm not absolutely sure of. But it's definitely a question mark that's being raised in retrospect, that he did not want to have his family come out.
Okay, now your impression, before we go further, Amiri, is, I mean, is he, a weak individual? His self-confidence, self-esteem's down? Is he a slacker? Is he, you have a wide range of personalities.
Yeah.
And he's not sounding none too good as far as I'm concerned.
The fact is that, we really don't know what his personality is. We really don't know much of anything about him. And I'll tell you that what I have heard from my source, a former CIA officer, counterterrorism officer for 16 years in the CIA, who maintains his contacts within the agency, is that the CIA did not know much at all about him when they signed him up to be an agent or an asset. And that is because, again, going back to curveball, they were so eager to have somebody who could tell them something that they were willing to settle for somebody who told them, look, I don't know anything really directly about this program because I'm not involved in it. I just happen to know some people who are in the program, and maybe I can, find out stuff. So, the very fact that he really didn't know anything and was honest about it, or at least seemed to be honest about it, was what convinced the CIA that he was not a dangle, not a double agent. And again, we really don't know, his motivation, but the suspicion that I share is that he was indeed working for Iranian intelligence and that he took the CIA in it completely. So, here's the punchline of this story now. The news media has been reporting for weeks and weeks that this guy, Shahram Amiri, defected to the United States and has been giving the United States valuable intelligence about a covert Iranian nuclear weapons program. And there are, I can cite you at least four stories that have repeated that theme. Now what I'm hearing from this former CIA official who has his own sources in the agency, two people who are very knowledgeable about the Amiri case, is that what he told the CIA, in fact, was that there is no Iranian nuclear weapons program.
Well, that's not what they wanted to hear.
That is not what they wanted to hear. You're absolutely right.
All right, when we come back here with Gareth Porter, he's the author of Amiri, told CIA Iran has no nuclear bomb program. Well, then what the heck good are you? You know, we're going to find out. I want to know how is it he gets to go back? I mean, and not be, you know, and remain undead. I don't know. We'll talk about that, too, when we come back here on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, in just a little bit.
Roads? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Oh, Gareth Porter, what's his mission? How about some truth, justice, and I don't know what used to be the American way, whatever that was. You know, it's getting to be to where people look back and they see that American way is just fibifying. I don't know what else you call it. CIA is well, it seems like, Gareth, that the CIA, are they coming clean on this thing? They got their, you know, reports that they're giving. Somebody there saying, yeah, you know, maybe what? I mean, what are we getting out of them?
Well, look, I mean, I think that you have to distinguish between the people who are actively sort of recruiting agents and taking the initiative in trying to penetrate Iranian society. I think those people would love to get their hands on somebody who would reveal, you know, what they hope would be a covert nuclear weapons program. But I think the analysts, the people who are supposed to be telling the president the truth, you know, more or less try to do the right thing in terms of finding the truth. Not by any means perfectly, and there's a lot of differences among them. Let's be honest about this. But there's a big difference between the folks who are involved in the field, doing essentially covert operations to try to penetrate the society, and the people who are trying to ferret out what's really going on.
Well, all right, who's really trying to ferret out what's really going on? Is it the policymakers?
Let's look at it this way. In 2007, the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community, but the CIA was the 600-pound gorilla in that overall group of intelligence agencies, put out a national intelligence estimate on the Iranian nuclear program. And what it concluded was something that was not well received by a lot of people in Washington, and certainly not well received by Israel and Europeans who were allies of Israel. And that is that Iran stopped work on nuclear weapons research in 2003 and had not resumed as of 2007 when this estimate was put together. So ever since that estimate in November 2007, you've had just incredibly strong pressure on the United States government and on the CIA to drop that estimate, that conclusion in that estimate, and to revise it in favor of a finding that Iran is indeed working on actively on nuclear weapons. And I can go into chapter and verse on that, but I can tell you that that Israel has promoted a number of stories about a nuclear trigger that are, as far as I'm concerned and as far as the CIA's analysts are concerned, fabricated and phony as part of this effort to put pressure on the United States and on the CIA to revise that finding.
Okay. So here we have an opportunity. They get a guy. He's got the word radiation and nuclear associated with a gentleman that walked in to the image and said, hello.
Yep.
And we go, I'm a man cub. Okay, so they get this guy. They, for some reason, all of a sudden, he wants to be shipped off. They're going to find out, leaves his family, goes to America. Just quick answer some questions I want to get before I lose you. How long was he in America?
Well, it's not absolutely clear. He has said that he was kidnapped, of course, in Saudi Arabia in June, in early June of last year. So if we assume for the moment that he did indeed leave for the United States in June of last year, then he's been around for a little over a year.
So how did he wind up at an embassy in, what was it, Pakistan's embassy or something in Washington?
He was in Turkey, actually, where he walked in.
No. I mean here when he said he wanted to go back.
Oh, in Pakistan. I'm sorry. Here, yes. Well, here's the thing. When you are a defector, as the U.S. Intelligence Service assumed that he was, and you come to the United States under the auspices of the CIA, they do two things. First of all, they debrief him. Very extensive series of meetings where they learn everything that they can from sitting down and talking to him. And then they provide him with a new identity and relocate him to somewhere in the United States where he expresses a desire for where he wants to go, and they do their best to accommodate him. But until he is kind of settled in his new position, in his new identity, he is closely guarded. He is not free to go wherever he wants to go, or to talk to whoever he wants to talk to, or make phone calls wherever he wants to, because he's still an asset. He's still somebody who is under their care and feeding.
Well, not enough that he couldn't just walk into Pakistani embassy and say, I want to go home.
Well, it's
and the fact
clear,
that Pakistan
that
would even turn him over.
This. He began to indicate, I think, after his round of debriefings, which undoubtedly went on for several weeks and perhaps several months, and I would put this at early 2010, he began to express things that indicated that he wanted to go back. And at that point, he was still apparently not completely settled in his new identity. From what I understand, he was not yet relocated to a new place with a new identity, and he was still under guard, just as Yurchenko, the Soviet defector in 1985, was under a guard. He was not free to go wherever he wanted. But remember the story of Yurchenko. He was having dinner at a restaurant on Wisconsin Avenue with his guard, and basically just gave him the slip. He said, would you shoot me if I walked away? And the guy said, no, I can't shoot you. And he just walked away. So it's a very light guard, and it's certainly possible for a defector to walk away.
No, I wouldn't think it would be impossible. I tell you what my biggest interest was is the fact that the Pakistani government just took him and allowed him go to Iran.
Yes. Well, there's no legal way that the United States can prevent a defector from re-defecting to the country.
Yeah, but I know hundreds of millions of dollars that Hillary Clinton's just taken over to Pakistan to convince them to be a little bit more, acquiescent to the United States. That's what I'm talking about.
I see.
So,
the fact is that it wouldn't have made any difference, though, whether it was Pakistan or India or Azerbaijan. I mean, the fact is that there was no way that he could be prevented legally from going back to Iran. And
before I lose you, we got just a little bit here, a minute.
Yep.
We have now, we got what is the big push now to try and change, because we have a CIA estimate that's coming back that's saying,
right,
you know, there is no nuclear program. We go through blah, blah, blah. We're not going to change that. This guy didn't change her mind. There isn't. But that doesn't matter to somebody. Who doesn't it matter to? They want to push that idea anyway.
Well, look, you know, this is a very, very highly political question, as I've indicated. And the pressure is still very intense on the CIA and the intelligence community to shade this estimate, this what was being called a memorandum to holders, because it's basically a follow-up to the National Intelligence Estimate of 2007, to shade this in the direction of saying, well, you know, Iran has been doing certain things that we're not sure of, but basically you're right. It's not going to say that they have a nuclear weapons program. It's going to say the opposite.
Well, they'll go in one word, just say mushroom cloud, just give us something, you know, give us something. There's not going to be a mushroom cloud, but mushroom cloud's in the verbiage, so we can say mushroom cloud. I know the games that they're going to play, and there's going to be, and that's why we're glad we got you, Gareth Porter, keeping an eye on this. Please come back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Good now. We got Rich Famous from whose body is it anyway? You know, I just wanted to know who owns your body. I just said, because your body belongs to you. And if you go in bybbty.com, that's what you'll get. Because your body belongs to you. So you just take the first word letter from each of those words, and that, because your body belongs to you. Now, and you'll hear that from me a lot. Here, I put my hand on your shoulder, and I say, whose life is this? Because if it's not yours, then, I don't know, is it somebody else's? Whose is it? Well, you know, you might get some fundamentalists to say, you know, it's God's life. And I go, yeah, well, guess what? You're the ultimate steward of it. You're the one that's signed a contract. You're the one that's serving time. Okay, somebody's in charge. Somebody's going to be, you know, making the locomotion of this going this way, that way. Somebody's in charge. You know, somebody. Well, you know, I say you. Well, the thing is that what if you're a poor India resident sitting there going, you know, I got an extra kidney. You know, I got an extra kidney. You know, I'm going to sell my kidney. Heck, I tell you what. You know, I'll sell it right now. You can have one. How much is it to negotiate? Or even, you know, another option, you know what, I like to keep my body parts. They're all mine until I die. And then I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to put it on the market. I probably will be able to leave more to my children in value of me being dead from selling my body parts than whatever I got, you know, an insurance policy. You know, am I allowed to even have such thoughts? Well, so we got Rich Famous here. You know, is it Rich and Famous? Rich Famous, how'd that come up, man?
That was a name change that I did for myself back in 1980.
Hey, how's it working out? I guess it probably, you know, better than not. Well, go ahead and tell me.
Better every day.
Well, tell me, because your body belongs to you, where'd this come from, man?
Well, I don't know exactly where I started first thinking about this, but somewhere along the line, back a few years ago, due to reading that I have done, I became aware of the fact that there was this value in human body parts, and that people who were donating body parts were not getting any benefit of the financial trade that was taking place because of that donation. So I started wondering about why that was true and started thinking about, well, how can people start realizing some of the benefits that are being realized by others because of the what is termed gift of life donation of their body after they die.
Okay, now I understand this is a very good point, but I got to ask a question first. I'm like,
yeah.
Okay, so who is getting the financial benefit? I die. You have the doctor goes into the waiting room. I'm sorry. We could use and sign here and donor, or he had a donor card, and we're going to take and pass on life to every country because we love humanity. And somebody's paying something for something. Who's getting that money?
Well, from what I've been able to determine, most of this markup is being done by these middlemen entities, and sometimes it's really murky knowing who they are. There are all kinds of players in this action, and some of them are upfront organizations. They call themselves something usually with the title "Life" in the title. They're in every state. They go under the name of organ procurement organizations, and these are very strictly regulated by federal law. But there are other more murky operators on the scene. Middlemen, brokers, they call them. Sometimes they're just out-and-out criminals, but where there is a need, there are people who are fulfilling the need. So the markup mostly is being done in this middle area between the gift of life that is being asked from people who are either dying or they're already dead, and their family members are being asked to make this gift. But once the gift is given, then there is profit.
Okay.
And
I'm looking at, this is what I did. I go in a Google search, organ procurement Arizona. The first thing that comes up is a, here, let me go ahead and do this. What happens is I get a listing, organdonor.gov. I'm going, okay, so it's a government thing. So I click on organdonor.gov, and I click on Arizona. Now, if I did organ procurement Arizona, it goes to the same place. So I'm going, okay, so what are we getting here? I go to this site, and it tells me it's Donor Network of Arizona. Every state's got at least one to a few of these, and it's going, okay, so where do we have kind of events that they got? Well, we got the Donate Life Volunteer Transplant Speaker. We got the Rotary Club this, Kidney Foundation that, Catholic Charities, what you call it. Let's go to About Us. Donor Network of Arizona is the federally designated, okay, because that means I click on it, it goes to them. Federally designated, whatever that means, not-for-profit organ procurement organization for the state of Arizona, a tissue and eye recovery organization. DNA serves five organ transplant centers in Arizona with a combined combined capacity to perform heart, lung, kidney, pancreas, liver transplants. Our mission, we make the most of life through the gift of organ and tissue donations. We challenge ourselves, blah, blah, blah. DNA shares, oh, so they call it Donor Network of Arizona, which is DNA, well, that's clever, shares organs regionally and nationally through the United Network for Organ Sharing, Sharing's UNOS National Network. DNA is accredited by blah, 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 blah. Okay, so here we have this. Now, of course, this one is claiming a nonprofit, but, I mean, somebody's getting a paycheck. I don't know what that means, so explain
okay,
that to
well,
me.
Okay, look, I mean, let's address that issue, because the term nonprofit, I don't know very much about you or your organization. From what I can tell, you're active in Libertarian Party politics.
Yeah, no, it's my organs. I can sell them all I want. I want the money.
Okay, but if you, chances are you know more about business than I do. But the definition of nonprofit simply means that the company cannot pay dividends or any kind of other payout to investors. That doesn't mean they're not making income. They certainly are making income, especially the ones that are in this organ procurement area.
Oh, no. I'm with you, brother. I'm saying, okay. Look, somebody's getting a paycheck. I'll guarantee you
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. So whether all of the money that is made by these middlemen organizations is used to pay the salaries of their staff or to do further lobbying and fundraising and advertising and marketing, they are still making money. Now, if somebody is making a free gift of life, and then at the point that gift goes into a recipient, and suddenly something that was given freely is now $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, or, you know, sometimes more. Where did that money go to?
Well, I can tell you one thing. They got job opportunities here. They have department, tissue services for who? Funeral home and medical examiner liaison. Job title, communication specialist. Where? Triage. And then we have another one, donor support coordinator in triage. You know, so these guys, I can see ambulance chasers, man. You got the attorneys and you got the tissue guys. I mean, you know, they're just, you know, if you die, you got the donor guys on you. And if you don't die, there's the lawyer standing there. I mean, this is, you know, these guys, I can see, okay, reapers. Now, so the point that I want to get to is that, you know, is there a law? Are there laws that prevent me from contracting my own organs?
Yes, there appear to be. And let me just say, I'm not a lawyer, so I am just making this interpretation on my own. But there is a law called the 1984 National Organ Transplant Act that, the language says, prohibits payment of valuable consideration for making an organ donation. And what that means in practice is that somebody who is being asked to give the gift of life is not allowed to even ask for any recompense for that. But once the gift is given and it goes on down the chain of middlemen to eventually going into somebody who receives that organ, there is definitely markup that's happening. So somebody is making money along the way. And the main point about BIPTI is the donor is making nothing out of this.
No,
By force of law or just by being convinced that it's not right for them to do so. That the fact is that donors of organs and other tissue are not being paid anything. And in fact, the subject of actually possibly being paid never even is brought up.
Oh, no. You don't get to have the money, especially if they can market it for somebody else to get the money. And you just, it's altruism in its ultimate.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Me, Ernest Hancock, and I got Rich and Famous on. He's talking to us about because you own your body. You know what? That's good. You know, I'm definitely with you on that. You know, I own me because your body belongs to you. BYBBTY.com. And just the concept, and this has come up before, certainly in libertarian circles, is that I remember seeing on television, there would be this uproar. I mean, they make movies, made-for-TV movies, and it's in sitcoms, and it's on, you know, it's talked about in sci-fi, and on and on and on and on and on. And you have an individual that's living in a poor country, de la whatever, and he goes, you know what? A kidney, I could do without, and it would change. You know what I could do without? A lobe of one of my lungs. You know what I could do without? You know, need a gallbladder. You know, I can survive. You know what? Blood. I give blood all the time. Oh, you need semen samples. You know, you need to have. You know, I can father some children because I got nice hairline. I mean, whatever it is, it's your bodily fluids. It's your body part. It's yours, or it's not. And if it's not, then whose is it? Okay, so I can change my life. I can put myself, you know, I have, there was a friend of ours that had a surrogate mother that they couldn't conceive themselves. So they were able to do the test tube thing and so on, and had this young law student that right in her senior year, she carried their child, gave it to him, paid off all her legal bills and her school bills, get to be a lawyer. They got a child. It's all good. I mean, at what level are we allowed to use our bodies and they're ours? Well, here we have someone, you can change your entire life. You can bring yourself out of poverty. You can get your mother the operation. You can save your child's life. Do away with it. No, can't do that. Why? the National Organ Transplant Act of 1984. You can just do it on Wikipedia. It was like, 1984 Organ Transplant Act. Boom, there it was. National Organ Transplant Act, 84, approved October 19th, 84, amended 88 and 90, outlawed the sale of human organs and provided for the establishment of the Task Force on Organ Transplantation, authorized by the Secretary of Home Health and Human Services, I guess, HHS, to make grants for the, oh, so we got taxpayers doing that, okay, make grants for the planning, establishment, and initial operation of qualified organ procurement organization, OPOs, and establish the formation of the Organ Procurement and Transportation Network and Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients. It was sponsored by Al Gore and Orrin Hatch. I'm so shocked. Okay, now this is, there's already buzzwords in here. It's already got me all nutted up to begin with. One, it outlaws for me as an individual to benefit from my own organs or, you know, that of a loved one that passed or anything like that. And then it establishes a task force on organ transplantation. Well, I guarantee you that establishment was taxpayer funded. And then it's authorized, whatever the heck that means, by the Health and Human Services Department of the United States government to make grants, money for planning, establishing, initial operation of these organ procurement organizations that are formed, you know, to not only procure them, but transport them, and the scientific registry of the transplant recipient. This is like a bad sci-fi movie.
Well, all of that stuff that you just said, yes, that's all correct. I just want to, first of all, I don't know how limited our time is here, but I want to get this main idea about BIPT in the conversation. And the main idea here is, yes, your body belongs to you, of course. The other main idea is that somebody is making some money off of this.
Vote me.
Okay, me too. But beyond that, there are, in this whole discussion of donating body parts, whether while somebody's alive or after their death, the question of who gets paid comes into the question here. Now, there's very little discussion about paying donors for whatever they donate. But beyond the idea of giving some kind of monetary compensation to people who do that, the thing that I think is unique about the BIPT idea is the idea of making a contract ahead of time so that I'm going to get paid now. I'm going to enter into a contract with company XYZ. At the time of my death, company XYZ comes and claims my remains. They do whatever they want to do with it. I've already been paid. Nobody has to harass my surviving family, try to convince them to make a gift of life donation. It's all taken care of. Meanwhile, I've gotten the benefit of that payment while I was alive, and my family got the benefit of that. Currently, the person who's deceased or about to die or his survivors get nothing out of this, and that is totally by force of law and force of just a heavy campaign of convincing people that they should just make this gift and then don't think about what happens to it after that, although what happens to it after that is a lot of people make a lot of money.
Yeah, no, I want to let you know, I got time for you in the next segment after the top of the hour. Are you available for that?
Sure.
Okay, so let's not worry about the time. I got plenty of time. Let's do it up.
All right.
Now, so the one thing that I did want to make sure that I remember all kinds of sci-fi movies made for TV and whatever, and you can think of a lot of excuses and problems they can come up with this, because let's say you're registered with this company, and they go, you know what, we need to knock Fred off here because, man, he's a tissue-type match with whatchacallit over here, and we already paid him. We get our money back and kind of, you know, and all this kind of, but I don't care because it's a private contract. It's a deal you want to make. I mean, if they got problem that you can worry about prosecution of them and murder and going to get you and whatnot, and a lot of times you can give up body parts and still lead a normal life. So I'm just going, it's whatever, it's your body. You can do whatever the heck you want. I don't care. My problem is with this law is it put it in the hands of, as much as they'd say, oh, we're the government. We love you. We don't want to have anything bad. We don't want the bad, evil private sector. You contract with anybody to do this. We're going to take care of you. And what do? They have the scientific registry of transplant recipients. So this is a government thing. Let me tell you what's going to happen. You got Dick Cheney. You know, he's needing a new heart. Well, guess what? They're checking their database. You know what I mean? So I feel way more concerned by this being in the hands of a government agency and them creating a monopoly on human body parts. And these are people, you know, they would lie us into war. They would steal from the next generation ungodly amounts of money. They would pillage and steal and do all this kind of, but they wouldn't, kill people to keep the leaders going to use their body parts because that would be wrong. I mean, you know, come on. Why would you want to have, where did this Transplant Act of 84 come from anyway? Why would they even think of such a thing that they would have government control on this and do it in such a way that they would fund private organizations in order to provide this service? Where did that come from?
I don't know the answers to that. And let me just say that I've gotten into this just from my own curiosity about the subject, which came from just starting, you know, reading stuff. I have no background in the law. I don't know anything. I have no background in medicine. I'm not politically active. This just seemed like a freedom and fairness issue. People should be free to control what happens to their own body, for crying out loud, if nothing else in this world. And also, if there's any money to be made out of this commerce, then the people whose bodies or body parts are being traded in a market should be able to get some of that money, and it can be a lot. This article that I came across a little while ago, I think it was from CNBC, it's called What is Your Body Worth? It indicated that if you were to squeeze every last dollar value out of a dead body, it could come to something like $250,000.
Doesn't surprise me one bit.
Pardon me?
Doesn't surprise me one bit.
No, I mean, when you start thinking about what people are paying for this or that part, and you know, usually people think about, you know, vital organs, kidney, heart, lungs, eyes are also very valuable. But beyond that, and also beyond this National Organ Transplant Act and all of the bureaucracy that's grown up around that, there's this other trade in other body parts, tissue, bones, other stuff, really isn't controlled by these laws, and so there are private operators who are active in this area. Are we going to break here?
Yeah, we got about a minute. Go ahead.
Okay. And this is not very highly regulated, but still, there's no indication that people who are giving up their bodies or whose bodies are being just taken one way or another are getting any benefit out of this lucrative trade.
When we come back, I want to delve into a little bit more of what laws need to be changed, what cultural, you know, ideology needs to be changed, and how has this idea, this concept, this webpage, your advocacy for this, what kind of impact has it had on people, your friends, neighbors, other people that contacted you through the website? How long have you been doing this? I mean, there's all kinds of questions we haven't even started on yet. Now we just understand the basic premise of you own yourself. Now what? We'll get to the now what when we come back.